is Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Kankin for Jane Lindholm. Linden State College and Johnson State College may merge into a single institution. Preliminary approval for the plan has been given by the board that oversees the Vermont State College system, but a final vote is still needed. The campuses, which are a little over an hour's drive apart, would remain separate, but college officials say combining the school's administrations would help reduce overhead and could expand opportunities for students. Concern has been raised about how all of this will affect each college's identity and their ability to recruit staff and students in the future. The state college system in Vermont includes more than Linden State and Johnson State. It's also Castleton University, Vermont Technical College, which has campuses in Williston and Randolph Center, and CCV, the Community College of Vermont, which has branches across the state. So how would a merger between two of the schools serve the overall state college system? Here to talk about what it may mean for students, faculty, and the state college system's beleaguered budget is Jeb Spalding, chancellor of the state college system. Chancellor Spalding, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Nina, thank you very much. I'm glad to be with you all today.
How many students are enrolled in the entire college system right now?
Well, we have close to 12,000 students on a headcount basis. Some of those are out-of-state students, so, you know, roughly about 10,000 Vermonters.
Oh, and how about Linden and Johnson specifically?
Yeah, Linden is maybe around 1,100. It seems to fluctuate between 1,000 and 1,200, and Johnson between 1,200 and 1,400. So you're talking about, you know, relatively small colleges.
Right.
And, you know, what we know across the country, and by the way, small tuition-dependent independent colleges are under even more stress than public ones. But the smaller tuition-dependent colleges are definitely having to deal with a demographic situation where there are fewer and fewer traditional college-age-going students and costs that are going up. The expectations from the federal government in terms of grant compliance and making sure that you are taking serious any missteps or inappropriate actions on a harassment or discrimination basis or sexual misconduct are serious issues that we have to address. People want to make sure that students don't only just show up on the first day of college, but graduate as close to on time as possible. And all those things cost money. And the combination of the demographic trends and the costs are something that all colleges are having to address. And, you know, we're no exception to that.
You've been on Vermont Edition before talking about that very issue, that the fact that the college system's budget shortfalls have been going on for years. Talk about what's led up to this proposed consolidation for listeners who may not know just how severe an issue this is.
Well, the first thing is that the Board of Trustees and the Chancellor want to be able to say to current and prospective students and families, and to school counselors and teachers and other partners, that we're absolutely committed to keeping the campuses in Linden and Johnson open, and not only open, but offering a high-quality education for generations to come. And, you know, we've seen one small college in Vermont close its doors. That's going to be happening more frequently across this country. And we are trying to be proactive in ensuring that's not going to happen with either Johnson or Linden State College. As I mentioned, it is the small tuition-dependent colleges. And in our case, even though we're public, we don't get much money from the state, so we are heavily tuition-dependent, are the most vulnerable to those financial challenges. So really, it's trying to be proactive to ensure that those campuses are going to remain viable and vital for the long run.
You've avoided calling this proposal a merger, instead describing it as a unification, more on the administrative level. And I understand current Johnson State President Elaine Collins is expected to become president of the combined institution. Will that combined institution have a new or different name? And where will that president's office be located?
Well, the college will have a different name. We haven't decided, you know, haven't been through the process to know what that would be. It will be just to sort of give a hypothetical, Nina. It might be called Vermont State College Johnson, Vermont State College Linden. While we are trying to unify, or to use a different word, merge those two colleges into one bigger, stronger college, we are also totally committed to maintaining the individuality of each one of those colleges. And to offer a contrast, in Georgia, where they've done at least a half a dozen straight-ahead mergers, where they've merged colleges or universities into one, they have actually come up with one new name and one new mascot and decided which of the campuses are going to have the men's basketball team or the women's soccer team. We have conferred with the NCAA and confirmed that if we do it right, which we know we can do it because there are models that have, both Johnson and Lyndon will be able to maintain their full array of sports teams with their own mascots. And, you know, we are insistent upon trying to make sure that we do not homogenize those two campuses, that Johnson will still be the COPLAC. They very recently received a high honor of being the one college in Vermont that has been approved by the Council of Public Liberal Arts Colleges. That campus will maintain that distinction. Lyndon, as you know, has one of the top 10 mass communications is what I used to call it. Now it's electronic journalism degree programs. And they will still be known for those meteorology, those high-level programs that they have. So, you know, there will be a new name. We don't know what it is yet. But whatever that new name is, it will also include in that name Johnson and Lyndon. Where the president will reside, we have not crossed that bridge. What we do know is that the president needs to be a regular presence on each one of the campuses, and that you have to have a very high-level person. For example, normally in higher education, the second in command, let's say, would be the provost or academic dean. And it may be possible to have the provost for the new college with two campuses living on one and the president on another, as long as they're back and forth on a very regular basis. What we, you know, getting back to the merger versus unification, you know, it could be a distinction without much of a difference. But the reason we use unification is because many people have a preconceived notion of what a merger is. They often think it's corporate. They think it's merging one into another, like a hostile takeover. Somebody wins and somebody loses. And when we use the word unification, it gives us the chance to say that's not what we're talking about. We are talking about creating something bigger and stronger, the best of both campuses, not merging one into another.
Listeners, if you're just joining us, we're talking about the proposed unification merger, however you want to describe it, between Lyndon State College and Johnson State College, a move officials believe will help reduce administrative costs and potentially expand opportunities and resources for students. Jeb Spalding is my guest today. He's the chancellor of the state college system. Listeners, you can join the conversation by calling 1-800-639-2211. It's 1-800-639-2211. Before I jump to callers, Chancellor, what do you expect to save by doing this? What's the, when you look at the bottom line savings by combining these administrative groups and reducing some redundancies, how much money will you save?
Well, we're going to provide that analysis to the Board of Trustees by the end of September. So we got approval last week of the concept in general, with the also the directive that we need to prepare a thorough financial analysis on what the upfront costs are to accomplish a unification and what the long-term savings are. But, you know, we know we could save $500,000 a year if we could just consolidate the three top administrative positions. You know we can if we could cut 5% off of the combined salary and benefit costs, that'd be $1.5 million a year. We'll get more savings through shared services and so forth. But, you know, I want to emphasize importantly, yes, part of this is about trying to make sure the colleges are financially solvent, but it's also about providing additional opportunities for students so that when students, you know, are asking, gee, what's going to change for me at Johnson or Lyndon? What I say is you're going to get everything you currently get at Johnson or Lyndon, plus over time you're going to increasingly get access to the resources of the other campus as well. We have professors at each one of those campuses that have specialties that they don't have on the other campus. Sometimes we have advanced level courses that can't run because they can't fill with just the students on one campus. We're going to be able to expand the academic offerings, the co-curricular offerings, student exchange, student support services. So I think it's really, it's also going to, you know, provide a bigger, more diverse faculty environment. So, you know, I think that's going to be great. And to the extent we save money, I mean, really, we want to be spending the limited dollars we have, and yes, they're limited, on things that matter to students. And, you know, administration is generally not one of those things, Nina.
Well,
the other thing is, if I could, I know we want to get to calls, but it's also about strengthening our impact. Let's just take, for example, that both Johnson and Linden do have excellent but very small, thin communications and marketing staff. You know, we're not talking about eliminating one or the other. We're talking about combining and getting more impact by having a more substantial communications and marketing effort. The same could be done with development efforts, you know, fundraising efforts. So some of it's about saving money. Some of it's about expanding opportunities. Some of it's about being stronger and more effective, having a better recruitment ability for future students. And most importantly, you know, for parents and students and the community members, knowing that the Board of Trustees is saying we are not going to close a campus. We are going to take proactive steps to make sure that Johnson and Linden, you know, continue to employ a lot of people, act as the critical access point for many Vermonters in a part of the state that wouldn't have access to post-secondary education if it weren't for one of those campuses. So, you know, it's a big deal, but I think it's a totally positive thing.
Well, let me let some callers jump in. We've got a couple of recent graduates and students that are calling that want to weigh in on this issue. Let's go to Michael, who's calling from Lindenville. Hi, Michael. Welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hello, Nina.
Go ahead.
Good morning. Or good afternoon, I should say.
Hi, Mr. Spalding. So you were just at my graduation in May at Linden State,
yep,
where I graduated with a business degree. And so it just so happens that I took a business leadership class in the fall, and one of our semester-long projects was to look at what should Linden College look like in 20 years and how should it get there. And our number one conclusion was that the Vermont State Colleges should stop competing with each other and collaborate together. And so it was exciting to hear the announcement last week. Kind of stating that conclusion.
Michael, are you talking about various areas of study at the two campuses? You know, you should only have one area at one and try to reduce redundancies with majors?
There are redundancies, but I think our main goal would be to, right now it seems like Linden tries to pull in more students by offering more classes and more majors, and we felt that that was the opposite way that it should go, that they should figure out what they do best and strengthen those. And also, and Johnson should do the same thing and maybe stop, you know, so if there's not a math major at all for Linden State Colleges, you know, which there is now, maybe there's only, you know, maybe there'd be only one or two, or, you know, maybe environmental science. Maybe Linden's really good at environmental science. And so somebody who is recruiting in Massachusetts is recruiting for all the state colleges, they can say, oh, you want to be a teacher? Well, Johnson State College has a terrific teaching department, or if somebody says, oh, I really want to, you know, do recreational management, that same recruiter can say, oh, we have a terrific program at Linden State.
Michael, we've got it. Let me throw that to Jeb Spalding, because just as you, Chancellor, were talking about reducing redundancies at the administrative level, you've got Michael here who's saying maybe we should do that in our course offerings at the college level as well.
Yeah, I think that some of the benefits from unification are going to take a while to recognize, and certainly they're going to take a while to implement. So, you know, in the academic area, I think over time the faculty will figure out how they can actually complement each other and not be redundant. I don't anticipate all of a sudden having faculty layoffs or anything like that, but, you know, we do have a lot of faculty that are fairly, you know, deep into their careers. And over the coming years, by having the campuses look together, where are they overlapping? Where do they have gaps where together they could fill them with new people coming in that would serve both of those campuses is a wonderful opportunity. And Michael, you mentioned you were in the business program. That's an area where the faculty members at Linden and Johnson are already working to collaborate and teach courses together. Linden now has two, what I call it, people call them different things, but I call them connected classrooms. And Johnson is about to complete a connected classroom that will allow a professor at one of those campuses to originate, you know, live, not like, you know, online or something, that live, a program with students on both campuses. And you can imagine a professor might originate that particular class from Lyndon 1 week and from Johnson the other week, so that you have, you know, face-to-face contact with your professor. So, you know, some of this is already happening. And I might say some of this collaboration is going to be more than just these two colleges. In this case, you know, we were looking at, okay, you know, in addition to what we can do on a, on an entire system level, are there some pairs of colleges where they are close enough and have, you know, some kinds of synergies that are already in place that would allow them to actually unify? And the conclusion that, that I've reached with Johnson and Lyndon is the answer is yes.
Let me jump in with an email that Philip wrote in. He works at Lyndon State, and he says, I and many others are concerned that this merge is a step towards closing or at least significantly scaling back Lyndon State College. He says, if the administrations are combined, many positions in each administration will become redundant. The fear is that we will be looking at large layoffs. Jeff Spaulding, how do you address Philip's concerns about, you know, this may be being the tip of the iceberg when it comes to cuts?
You know, Nina, I see my role is ensuring that the colleges thrive into the future. What we know right now is, having nothing to do with unification, that both Lyndon and Johnson have lost in excess of $1 million in the fiscal year that closed at the end of June, and the budgets approved by the Board of Trustees for this coming year also include $1 million-plus deficit at each one of those institutions. Job security is going to be much enhanced by being a bigger and stronger college than by maintaining the status quo. If you're at all familiar with Lyndon, they are going through a budget-cutting exercise right now, and we are people-intensive institutions. So, you know, I really want to repeat that. Job security will be enhanced by a bigger, stronger college than the status quo.
Let me take in one more caller before we wrap this up. We're going to go to Charlotte and talk with Joshua. Hi, Joshua. Welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hi. My name is Joshua Cook. I graduated from Lyndon State Music, Business, and Industry in 2012. My wife graduated in 2013 with a business degree. I'm sorry, I'm having a little bit of a hard time hearing you right now.
Joshua, I'm just going to ask you to be as quick as you can. We've just got about a minute and a half left.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I just wanted to start by addressing one concern about redundancies about classes. As a graduate of music business, I understand more better than most people that the state college system already has methods in place to prevent redundancies in majors, et cetera, because the reason why music business existed was in part due to the fact that they couldn't have a music program anymore.
Right.
Yeah. And I wanted to also bring up that I really believe in this unification. I do. I really hope that this will bring about the resources that Lyndon needs to give its students the classes that, you know, these kids deserve. I was a very proud graduate of Lyndon State. I was an employee. I was a recruiter for Lyndon State for a little while. And I actually really greatly believe in Lyndon Johnson University.
Right. All right. Well, Joshua, thanks for taking the time to call in. We're going to have to leave it there. Jeb Spaulding heads the Vermont State College System. Chancellor, thanks very much, as always, for making time to be on the program.
I really appreciate the time. Thank you.
As we've been discussing, Spaulding is preparing a report for the trustees of the Vermont State College System on how this merger could be accomplished. They plan to vote on the plan on September 29th. Coming up, passenger rail service in our region. Advocates of train travel have long argued for a faster route to New York City and easy links direct to Montreal. Just ahead, we'll learn if those ideas are any closer to reality. This is Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Kack. Anyone who has visited Europe has found that getting around from country to country and city to city can be done efficiently by train. But then you return home to find that rail travel in the U.S. is isolated to very specific regions and cities. There are several projects in various stages of development that could change the passenger rail map over the next decade. VPR's Jane Lindholm spoke with Dan Delabriere, of the Rail Program Director for VTrans, for this update.
Let's talk about first the most developed of these three particular projects. And I understand that's the passenger service linking Rutland to Burlington. What work has been done on that so far?
So we've had a goal for several years to extend the Amtrak Ethan Allen service, which currently terminates in Rutland. We've had that goal to extend that all the way to Burlington for several years, and we've been working on this for a long time. And it's about 65 miles of rail, and over the past several years, we've been doing several upgrades to the point where this past year we applied for a Tiger grant, which is federal money, to what we called kind of the completion of the project. So we applied for $12 million, of which we got $10 million from the federal government. And that'll go towards the final stage of the project, which is $26 million. So what we have left to do on that section of track is about 11 more miles of new track. The rest of the 64 miles has already been upgraded. We have continuously welded rail, which basically takes the old stick rail where there's joints about every 39 feet, which creates the old nostalgic clickety-clack as you go down the rails. That doesn't exist anymore. So it's continuously welded all the way up through. There's no more joints, and we have 11 more miles left to do. We have three passenger platforms to install. We're anticipating Middlebury, Vergennes, and Burlington. We have a couple of bridges to upgrade. We've got several crossings that need to be upgraded because the passenger trains run at a higher speed than the freight trains, and so we're going to be putting in a lot more sets of lights at crossings and things like that for safety. And all those projects total up to about a little over $26 million, and we have about 4 years, the next 4 years, to complete all that. We have 2020 as our completion date, but we're hoping to be done sooner than that.
And the benefit to passengers here, in addition to allowing people to travel between Rutland and Burlington, is that from Rutland you can get to New York City. So this is a way for Burlington passengers to get more quickly to New York City, right?
Yeah, that's correct. So currently, Vermont has two passenger trains. We have the Vermonter, which goes from St. Albans all the way down through Vermont and then continues down to New York City and actually continues to Washington, D.C. But the Ethan Allen stops in Rutland, so that one also goes to New York City. You know, for people that live in Burlington, they have to now go to Essex and take the Vermonter, which goes down through Massachusetts, Connecticut, and then heads down to New York City. So it would be a little quicker ride for people that live in Burlington, benefit from owners from our largest city that want to go to New York City. So we think it's something that needs to be done.
You mentioned that as part of this project, there's some work that needs to be done in Middlebury, and the rail project in Middlebury has been a real sore point for some people in town. And one of the questions has been whether the passenger line, should continue through the town as the tracks go now or go outside it. Some people in town are really concerned about having a rail improvement project that V-Trans says could take 2 years. And many people in town say this is going to significantly impact not only traffic flow, but businesses and the way the town just has a flow right now. What's been decided about the project in Middlebury?
Well, we're very sensitive to the folks in Middlebury, and I think one thing that in the initial stages of the project, I think there was, I'm not going to say confusion, but a lot of not more education needed to be done about what the actual project was, and I think the as people got educated to what the project was, I think the town itself and the residents of the town, we've done a better job lately of giving them the information they need, and I think people are understanding the project and the need for the project now, although in the beginning I think there was some confusion. So I think the benefit of the project really for the town of Middlebury is that for a passenger station to work efficiently, it really needs to be where people can get to the train. So in this particular case, if you tried to move the tracks, say, outside of town, then it wouldn't be an efficient passenger station. So having the tracks where they are, I think, makes the most sense, which goes right through town. The project itself consists of replacing two bridges with a sort of a linked-type tunnel structure that's going to allow for the center of town to actually have a very beautiful green. We're going to enhance the downtown area. The track itself is going to remain kind of under the town that you won't even really be able to see it through town. When it's all done, it's going to be great for the town of Middlebury. I think in the construction phases, There will be, you know, there'll be some impacts in the downtown, but we're going to minimize those as much as we can.
Let's talk about one of the other rail projects that's in the works. Many Vermonters are really excited about the prospect of reconnecting high-speed rail between Burlington and Montreal. There's been some movement on that at the federal government level in terms of figuring out where customs could be. So when are we going to see that rail?
Where we are right now with that project is both the United States government and the Canadian government have signed a treaty that basically says we all agree that we want to allow the U.S. customs to be able to work in another country, which in this case is Canada. So they basically said, yeah, we all agree that it makes sense for us to have a border station in Montreal. Now what we're doing is the two governments have to agree on kind of what the details of that are. And that's where we stand right now, and the two governments are working on that. We would hope to be back in Montreal in the next 3 years, but at this point it's really tough to pick a date when we can say that's the date it's going to be. After we work out the two governments kind of work out the big deal on this treaty details, then we've got some, there's some infrastructure work to do. There actually has to be a station in Montreal Station, downtown Montreal. There has to be a facility built that's going to house the custom border protection folks, as well as the ticketing folks. And we have a location that has been proposed. We are working on designs for that. We've got a lot to do, but we've got a lot of great people working on it on both sides of the border, and we're very excited about it.
And the idea here is that customs would be in Montreal so that passengers don't have to stop right at the border and do all of the customs stuff there?
Yeah, that's correct. It would work similar to the airlines where you would fly into a different country, and as you exit the airplane, or in this case, if you exit the train, you exit directly into the customs facility. They check you into the country so that you don't have to stop at the border and take the time for the people to, you know, kind of go through the train and do all that stuff. You do it as you exit the train, and on the way back into the U.S., you go through customs, you load the train, you don't stop at the border. The first stop into the U.S. would be St. Albans.
And so for V-Trans, the question is, can the two federal governments get the last details ironed out and then you can start your portion of the construction?
That's correct. And we need to work out not only the details about the construction, but once it gets beyond the federal level, then we have to figure out, you know, who's paying for the service, who's paying for the station, who's paying for... There's a lot of things to work out, and I think we've had preliminary meetings with all these folks, and everybody's on board with, you know, it's a great concept, it's a great idea, and we all want to work together to get it done.
So, Dan, let's talk about this third project as well, and this is the prospect of daily commuter service between Montpelier and St. Albans. Why those two cities?
We get this question all the time. Why isn't there any sort of commuter between the northern part of the state and Montpelier because so many people commute every day? And we have not been able to answer that. What we're doing now is we're conducting a study, and it's really just a study to figure out, is it even feasible? Would anybody ride it? What would the cost be? So it's a very preliminary study, but we're just beginning it. If we find that it's feasible, then we'll have to figure out, you know, if we can afford it. But as part of the study, there is a public comment period. I don't know the dates off the top of my head, or even if dates have been established yet.
Well, Dan DeLabriere is Rail Program Director for V-Trans. Thanks very much for talking with us, Dan. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
DeLabriere spoke with VPR's Jane Lindholm. We've been hearing all week about the fractures between the Sanders and Clinton backers at the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia. But outside the convention hall, one Burlington man has a high-profile role in amplifying the politics of art and pop culture. More on that just ahead. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Katkin for Jane Lindholm. So much of the news we've heard from the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia has come from the convention hall. The speeches, the competitive chanting between Clinton and Sanders supporters, the official proceedings of the convention itself. But just outside the convention bubble, the vibe quickly changes. A 15-minute walk away from the convention center is an energetic, art-filled space where Rock the Vote is hosting a pop-up art exhibition called Truth to Power. It's centered around some of the major issues of concern for young people today: climate change, college debt, sexual assault, and criminal justice. One of the driving forces behind the exhibit, Luis Calderon of Burlington.
I went to Burlington High School. I graduated from Burlington High School in 1992. I am, in fact, a fighting seahorse. I was actually technically the seahorse one year. I was the mascot as well.
Okay, but that's the least of Calderon's resume. He was just named the Vice President of Marketing and Creative at Rock the Vote. And up until June, he was with the Bernie Sanders campaign, where he managed arts, culture, and youth vote, which is no small job in a campaign that was fueled by young voters. VPR's Emily Alfin Johnson met with Calderon at the Busy Truth to Power pop-up art exhibit in Philadelphia.
For my good people of Vermont, my home state, we are in an amazing space full of issues-based artwork, people coming together that have honest and interesting conversations about the issues that we're facing today in America and talking them out and ultimately identifying the truths to these issues and then understanding that the power lies within us, the American voter, especially during this election cycle.
Can we walk around a little bit and can you walk me through some of your favorite stuff?
Sure, I'd love to take you through.
Tell us what we're looking at right now and sort of the story behind it.
Well, these are two flags hanging and they're bleached, right? You have an American flag and then you have a rainbow flag. And they have been bleached. All of the color has been taken out of them. So you see faint, faint color. You see a faint yellow, and you get an idea of what that is. This piece is called Transfiguration and the Trans Flag. What if in America we didn't see anyone in terms of gender? What if everyone was just considered a person? What if a person is measured by their spirit, a beautiful white light, that we all have as spiritual beings having a human experience, right? That's what this piece says to me. That's what it means to me. I mean, let's take all these colors out. Let's take boundaries out. Let's take countries and landlines out and remember that we are all brothers and sisters on this planet for a finite amount of time, right?
Tell me a little bit about how you went from working for the Sanders campaign to being here. How did that transition happen? What brought you to working with Rock the Vote?
I live in Burlington, Vermont. I raised my family there, my wife Julie, my son Ravon and Olivia. We live in town. My mother moved my sister and I to Burlington when I was a young kid, when Bernie was the mayor, right? And I used to hang out at the 242 Main Teen Center on Main Street, and I became friends with the senator's kids, and those are my first and earliest and bestest friends, right? And Dave Driscoll and I worked together at Burton Snowboards. I was in marketing there, and he still works there. And on our lunch break, we would sit around and talk about Bernie and his potential run for the presidency. And I asked a million questions, like, you know, who's going to do the new poster, or what's the music going to be like? And when I left Burton, he created an opportunity for me to sit down with Bernie and Jane, and you know what my thoughts were on what I could do for the campaign, and you know they let me do it. And Bernie's mandate was don't make it about me, make it all about the issues. And I became the director of arts, culture, and the youth vote for the campaign. So I had the honor of holding that position for a year, and I left the campaign right after our California run. And you know, going across this country and seeing so many young people and seeing the passion and the energy and the enthusiasm for democracy was really, really moving. I swore that I would do everything I could to continue to keep that energy and momentum and that movement, our movement. I have dedicated myself to helping us see it all the way through. So it's been an honor to be part of Rock the Vote. That's how I made the transition from the Bernie Sanders campaign to this organization. And ironically enough, it was Rock the Vote in City Hall Park the summer of 1992 that there were, you know, they had a table in City Hall Park. There were two girls that were from UVM. They said, hey, come over. Are you registered to vote? I didn't even know what that meant. And I went over there. They signed me up. And it's just beautiful how it's been able to come around full circle that now I'm here and have the opportunity to bring more people into the political process.
So tell me a little bit about what we're looking at for people who can't see it.
Well, this is this series here is by this artist. His name is Michael D'Antonio, and it's three pieces of the series here. But the one that we're looking at right now is called The Talk. you have a father sitting on a couch opposite of their young son having a discussion. The TV's right behind them, and it says, no indictment in the police shooting of unarmed youth, right? There's a split screen on the TV. It's a cop, and then there's a kid who looks just like the little kid sitting on the couch, okay? In the background, there are a framed photo of Martin Luther King. This is a conversation that is happening every day. This is happening to us every day. I'm a person of color, right? I'm a father. I have a 16-year-old son, just turned 16. His mother and I just bought him a used Volvo as his first car. Why did I buy him a used Volvo? Because it's safe. We sat down. I said, son, I love you. This is a big responsibility. I'm so scared to let you go out in the world and drive, but I have to. Please promise me that you won't drink and drive. Please promise me that you'll wear your seatbelt. Please promise me that you won't get crazy in the car. This is a conversation that all fathers have with their sons when they turn 16. But because I'm a person of color and my son comes from me and looks different, I have to also have the conversation today that says, son, also, if and when you get pulled over by the police, please know that no matter what, you're going to be okay. I'm going to get you out. I just need you to know that so that you know that you're not in any trouble with me, so that you don't lose your composure, so that you don't get scared and fumble around and make that cop nervous. Keep your hands on the steering wheel so that he is less likely to lose his mind and shoot you and kill you. That's the conversation that as a father you have to have in America today with your 16-year-old son when he gets his first car.
And around the edges, I'm seeing names, most of which I unfortunately recognize.
I don't even want to see those names. I don't want to even see those names because that name could easily be my son. And I'm not prepared to even take that, you know, as a thought, right? So these are the issues. These are the issues that we're facing as Americans today. These are real issues.
Honestly, this is an incredibly emotional
place. This is the artist.
Michael D'Antuono. I'm from New York. I'm an artist from New York.
Wonderful to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Michael, what led you to doing these three pieces in this series?
Well, as an old white man, I assumed that racism was basically over in this country, but through all the videos of the police shootings, trying to be swept under the rug, that awoke me from my ignorance, the comfort of my ignorance, and I want to do the same with as many other white people to get them to see, in this case of the talk, to elicit empathy, to put yourself in someone else's shoes, that how would you feel if you had to give your child that talk?
So many conversations with my kids around the dinner table about the moments where they're like, the whole country seems like it's about to explode, and I have to stop and say, kids, this is what's going on. I gotta make you aware of this so you know what's happening here. Whether it be police violence, whether it be the Sandy Hook, maybe at this moment, insane conversation with your kids.
It's like that in 2016.
No.
Isn't that crazy?
It's beyond crazy. It's beyond crazy. It's almost, it's surreal almost.
And how does it make you feel to have that conversation? That I don't have to have that conversation to my kid, but you do. How does that make you feel?
It makes me feel, as a person of color in the United States, alienated.
Yeah.
By myself.
In your own country.
In my own country. A country that I love. A country that I've served for.
Really?
Yeah, of course. Of course. I'm the first person in my family born in this country. My parents are from Cuba. I'm the first person in my family born here. I'm from Miami. I moved to Vermont. I grew up in a beautiful, you know, pretty safe place. I got the opportunity and the privilege and the honor to be able to work for the senator for the campaign, and to still have all those accolades or whatever, still be, when I get pulled over, you know, it's terrifying. When we had just won New Hampshire, right? We just won New Hampshire. We're driving back. A kid who worked for me, white kid, driving his car. I'm sleeping. He's speeding. We get pulled over. Cop pulls us over. And, you know, normally the cop is on the left side of the door. Cop is all... I'm looking out to the left side to see if he's going to show up. All of a sudden, the cop opens the door on the right. Opens the door on my right side of the passenger.
Wow.
and is half an inch from my face yelling at us, right?
Really?
In New Hampshire. And the first thing that goes in my mind is this stuff, right? Like, please don't lose your mind. I don't want to end up dead. I'm looking at this kid like, don't go crazy, kid. Just do what he says. Just be cool, man. Like, let's just get out of here, right? Everything's fine. He gives the kids a ticket. Gives him a, doesn't even give him a huge ticket. Gives him a ticket, and we drive away, right? So here I am, a guy who's working on a presidential campaign. I just won New Hampshire, and in 1 second, none of that shit matters, man. Because I'm just some dude, you know? And there's some guy with the ultimate authority over me. These are issues that aren't necessarily at the presidential level. These are actually, in fact, issues that are at a local level, right? So what we're trying to do here with this installation and our campaign, the Rock the Vote, Truth to Power campaign, is to help educate young people and express to them how important it is that they, A, register to vote, and then, B, show up to vote, but not just at the presidential when all eyes are on it. We need you beyond that. We need you to vote for your school board. We need you to vote at a state level, at the midterm level. As you know, as we all know now, because of the work that my former boss, Senator Bernie Sanders of the great state of Vermont, did, he helped young people bring these issues to the forefront and talk about them and learn about the arcway of voting, right? Like, that it is not just one person that is going to miraculously cure all our problems, that we, the people, need to show up and do our job, which is vote people in or out of office, right?
All right, if you could bring one piece home that really you wish everyone in Vermont could see and appreciate and experience the way you and I are right now, which one, and can we go look at that one?
Personally, if I could bring one home, my absolute dream would be to take the 90-foot Keith Haring that is outside of our building. I mean, this building that we're in is, I don't know, like 12 floors, 12 plus floors. I don't know if we do that in Vermont yet anymore, right? just kidding. It is a beautiful painting that Keith Haring, the late great Keith Haring, made with his group that he worked with called City Kids. It's a painting of the Statue of Liberty. And Keith Haring was one of my favorite artists of all time. When I was young, it was like that was the first sort of street artist that I ever got exposed to. And I wish that I could bring that home. I wish that I had a building tall enough to display that in Burlington. I hope that maybe we do someday be able to bring that to Vermont and share this piece. The reason it's so special, it has not been in North America since the early 80s. It was here, and then it was shipped to Paris, where it lived on display for a little while. Then it was packed up and sat in a crate 10, 15, 20 years, whatever now. So this piece only exists right now. It'll go back into a box and go away. So I wish I could share this beautiful Keith Haring with the good folks of Vermont, and maybe we will if we bring this show on the road. This show is the launch of our campaign for Rock the Vote called Truth to Power. We'll be taking this concept to critical states during this election cycle. We'll be visiting college campuses, cities, wherever young people are. We're going to go there and we're going to have these conversations. And we want, again, to register as many young people to vote and keep them engaged in the political process. These young people that came out in support of Bernie, I know that the senator wants them to stay engaged and has expressed that. And so we hope that young people show up in November to get a new president.
So just as we were wrapping up, a bunch of people started gathering together, linking arms for what is seemingly a giant hug. And they're wrapping their way around some of the installations so that they can make more room.
You heard Luis Calderon, the vice president of marketing and creative at Rock the Vote, speaking with VPR's Emily Alfin Johnson. We have a ton of photos of the art they described and much more that you can check out on Vermont Edition's Facebook page. Our reporting from the Democratic and Republican National Conventions is supported in part by the VPR Journalism Fund. And that's it for Vermont Edition today. Tomorrow, we'll dig into a new reference book about vegetables from Eating Well magazine. This substantial volume is filled with recipes and gorgeous photography that will stir the hearts of even a casual vegetable eater. You can join us for that discussion tomorrow at noon. And next week is debate week on Vermont Edition. If you've only been paying occasional attention to the primary races in both parties, this is your chance to hear the candidates make their case for your vote. And we want to know, what questions would you ask the candidates? Record your question on your smartphone's voice memo app and send it to Vermont Edition at vpr.net. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri, Sam Gail Rosen, and Meg Malone, with production assistance from Jake Burstein. Mary Williams directed the program. Our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Nina Keck, in for Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.